Welcome to It's More Than That.
You know, at ASU for a while on our campus anyways, we would regularly get bomb threats and have to clear out the buildings. And oftentimes the bomb threats would be coded with critiques, if you will, about all the multicultural things that we were doing at the university.
Wow.
It's More Than That is a podcast by the University of Minnesota Duluth. I'm Paula Peterson. Often we don't understand the full story of someone's reality. Join me as we explore the complexities of the human experience. This week on the show, Fernando Delgado. So I am happy to have our guest on today's show, the Campus Climate Podcast, our EEVCA. I always have to think about that. Executive. No, I'm going to have to back up. I know this.
Do you want me to jump in?
Yeah.
It's Executive Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs.
EEVCA.
It just rolls off the tongue.
Yeah, it does. It does. Which in other institutions is called a provost, right?
Right, right.
Which is probably why it's tricky for some of us to say.
Yes.
Yeah. So Dr. Fernando Delgado.
Mm-hmm.
Is with us today in that EVCAA. That's right. I had two. It's two A's instead of two E's.
Right.
Gotcha. To talk us a little bit about kind of you and your newer at UMD, newer, I'm putting air quotes on,
mm-hmm.
Your thoughts about campus climate. You have insights from other institutions. Just happy to chat with you a little bit today. So if you don't mind, tell us a little bit about who you are and where you come from and how you ended up here.
Well, thank you, Paula. First thing, thank you for having me here. It's great to be part of the conversation that we have on campus. It's a necessary conversation. It's a conversation that not every institution wants to have.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thrilled that we have folks like yourself who are willing to carry the flag and nudge us forward in important ways. As you noted, I'm newer here. I've only been here now completing my third year.
Okay.
So it'll be 3 years in July. It still feels like I'm still getting to know the campus, both its cultural dimensions, but also just its physical topography. The community has been easier to get to know because I tend to just go out into the community and wander around. So it's been interesting to get to know not only Duluth and its various downtowns, but the greater metroplex that includes the areas on the other side of the lake in Wisconsin as well. And to try to get a sense for what's working, what's not working, in and around the university, because anytime we talk about climate, we're talking about microclimates and part of larger climates. And
mm-hmm.
so it's really hard to talk about any employee or student's experience at the university without thinking about what their experience is when they step out of campus or what people from the community bring to campus mm-hmm. when they come to work, come to visit, come to study.
Yeah, it's important to think about. So where were you before you arrived here 3 years ago? And by the way, 3 years, I didn't know it had been that long already.
I know.
Wow.
It goes by fast.
It does. Okay.
I spent 7 years at the University of Wisconsin, River Falls, which is just outside of the Twin Cities. We used to joke we are Wisconsin's Minnesota University, or Minnesota's Wisconsin University. Although it was a very rural campus and we had a College of Agriculture, the fact that we were so close to the metropolitan area meant that we took a lot of our, if you will, our social climate and our values issues refracted through that metroplex.
Mm-hmm.
Most of our students came from the Twin Cities. About 40% of our employees lived in the Twin Cities and commuted to Wisconsin. So we were very much identified with the Minnesota culture and the Twin Cities politics and vibe.
So that's 7 plus 3. That's 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you want me to go even further?
Well, we're just, where's home for you?
Well, I'm originally from California.
Okay.
I've lived in Woodbury or Duluth for the last 14 odd years. So before River Falls, I spent 3 years at Hamline University in St. Paul. And before that, we spent 2 years in Mankato. And then before that, I spent 10 years at Arizona State.
Oh, wow.
So the weird story is, how does one leave Phoenix, Arizona for Minnesota?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is very simple. The presence and the absence of water.
Okay.
So the real story is, we started to have kids in my family and we wanted to be close to grandparents. But the other situation was, the literal climate in Phoenix was something that really worried us, because it was an unsustainable environment.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, is in Phoenix, in some ways, it's unsustainable in multiple ways. So you can't add that many people, making that many demands on nature in a very fragile environment, and think you're going to have a positive outcome. On the other hand, that cultural value towards exhausting the environment also plays into the social relationships. And so even though it was a vibrant and very diverse metropolitan area of, at the time, almost 3.5 million people, some of the issues we worry about on campus and in Duluth were incredibly visible in Phoenix. Hmm. The level of racism, particularly homophobia, institutionalized homophobia, really dramatic and coarse discourse about immigrants, even though the economy relied on that hidden labor that was out in public. Really coarse conversations about the agenda of the university and its role in society in educating people and socializing people. Those were all regular conversations that we had in and around Arizona State amongst the region's universities. And from within the university, you could get a sense that at times the external environment was quite hostile to what we were doing. Mm-hmm. And yet what we were doing was in fact being a social and economic engine for the community.
Yeah.
And so it was a weird kind of relationship. So I had a great time at Arizona State. I learned a lot. But when we moved to Minnesota, it was time to move to Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. So that sounds like a lot of what we might call overt bias.
Oh, definitely. Oh, definitely.
As opposed to what we talk more about here of the more implicit, unconscious.
Oh,
not that we don't have overt bias, but it sounds like the balance there was more on the overt side.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's always going to be bias whenever you have humans. There's a particular pejorative word that is often used towards Latino people. I've never heard it in Duluth. I heard it on a weekly basis walking across campus or walking in the community when I lived in Phoenix.
Mm-hmm. Against you.
Against me, yeah. Or people like me.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So how does it feel different here then? I mean, does the covert...
The covert is difficult because it's hard to call it out.
Yeah.
It's not hard to call it out for those people who hold those feelings because they sooner or later make themselves be known. It's harder to call it out for the rest of us who might be considered bystanders because then it doesn't register for them. So the sense of urgency may not be as real. You know, at ASU for a while on our campus anyways, we would regularly get bomb threats and have to clear out the buildings. And oftentimes the bomb threats would be coded with critiques, if you will, about all the multicultural things that we were doing at the university.
Wow.
And so that becomes easier to have a conversation when you know that part of what you're attempting to do as an educational institution is threatening to people and they're reacting in that kind of violent way.
Mm-hmm.
When you don't see that and you don't experience it in your office, in your workplace, in the spaces in which you inhabit on a campus, and you hear other people talk about it, it still feels very remote and there's not that sense of urgency or reality.
Yeah.
And I think that's the difference.
Yep. So maybe easier in ways, but harder in other ways.
Yeah.
If that's fair to say.
Easier in ways to require the conversation, harder in ways because the people who are at the heart of that, their morale, their sense of being beat up is pretty palpable.
Yeah.
So for example, when I was a faculty member teaching intercultural communication, at one point in one semester, I got enough death threats that for a few weeks, I had a police officer, plainclothes police officer, follow me to class, stand outside the classroom. When class was over, I taught at night, would walk with me to the car. We would check out the car, make sure it was safe. He would make sure that I got in and out of the parking lot safely. And then he would go back and, I assume, file a report. All because of something that I had taught in classrooms at the University of Iowa and at Arizona State for a decade without any concerns.
Yeah.
But suddenly somebody thought they heard something who wasn't even in the class, and they decided it was appropriate to start calling my answering machine at work and be very specific about who I was, where I worked, what I drove, and how they were going to harm me. That's kind of weird.
Yeah, yeah. And it's something that I think many of us have no concept. I mean, it's hard to even understand that that could happen and that, that I mean, it sounds, I've heard about it, but I guess I've never had a conversation with anyone who's experienced something quite that overt.
And like I said, I was not alone. My colleagues that were in gender and women's studies experienced far worse symbolic and physical violence against either what they were doing or their office spaces, for example, in terms of vandalism. And it wasn't just generic vandalism. I mean, it was very, very targeted, very precise, very aggressive forms of vandalism that called out who they were and put them at risk. And so folks like that, we tended to lose from the university.
Oh, sure.
So that's the problem when it's that public and you still struggle with how to come up with a productive response to create the kind of culture you want to create at a university.
Mm-hmm. So how does that, those experiences inform who you are and how you do what you do here at UMD in such a very different climate?
Sure. It's difficult because the role I had as a faculty member meant that I was constantly in front of students.
Mm-hmm.
I had the direct ear of my faculty colleagues in my department in my college. I could make responses through the curriculum. I could make responses through my pedagogy. Here, I make responses through my policies.
Okay.
Sometimes I make it through the ways I show up, for example, being here in this podcast. Sometimes I make it through pronouncements or interpersonal interactions, primarily with employees. It still informs because what I recognize is that there's always going to be a segment of society, hopefully it's a shrinking segment, that we're probably never going to reach successfully.
Mm-hmm.
We're certainly not going to make a tremendous difference in the 2 to 4 or 5 years they're with us if they're students. I think that's one of the misnomers we have. We get students who are largely fully formed in many ways and semi-formed in other ways. And to think that we are going to have significant impact in fundamentally changing who they are, that may be a bridge too far.
Mm-hmm.
We can help them understand parameters. We can communicate with them about the values that we espouse and why we espouse them. We can help socialize them into different approaches to the human experience. But we might not be able to fundamentally change their value set or their belief system. Employees similarly pose that challenge.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody were to come to me and say, I'm going to change the way you think. Well, I'm nearly 53 years old. I could be a better version of who I am. I could be a worse version of who I am. I'm not going to be a fundamentally different version than what I am.
Mm-hmm.
So the ranges in which we operate on, we have to be realistic and pragmatic about, which is a challenge because most of us got into higher ed because we're idealistic.
Right.
And so one of the things that has tempered my approaches over time is what's going to make a significant structural cultural difference. And by significant, I don't mean moving somebody from A to Z. I mean moving dozens of people from B to C.
Hmm. Okay. Is this coming from your academic mm-hmm. lens? Is that okay?
Yeah. So the model I used to use in intercultural communication when I used to train as a is a model called cultural competency or communication competency. Mm-hmm. So the way we refract it is knowledge, motivation, and skill. And I used to always tell the students, okay, we spend X number of weeks talking about knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
What do you know about your culture? What do you know about other cultures? Easy enough to do, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Then we talk about skill. How well do you listen? How well do you communicate? How flexible are you as a communicator? What are the models in which we use in conflict and initial interactions in sustaining relationships? All that's great. But the metaphor I always used is, do you play softball? Students would raise their hand. Yes, I play softball. Great. Do you know the game? Yes, of course we know the rules of the game. Fantastic. Are you good at the game? Can you hit the ball? Can you catch the ball? Do you know how to grip a softball to throw it well? Sure. Great. So you know the game and you know how to play it well. Do you have days where that doesn't matter and you don't get out of bed to go play softball? Yep. Okay. So without disposition or motivation, it doesn't matter how much knowledge or skill you have.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, we know in sports and other walks of life, if you have sufficient disposition and motivation, that can overcome a whole lot of skill and knowledge deficits. Because in Spanish, we have this word called voluntad. You have this energy that you want to try, you want to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And human beings being what we are, social animals, we tend to accept and acknowledge that effort and meet you halfway so that we can carry each other to the end line. And so I used to always tell the students, we're going to give you a lot of knowledge. We're going to give you a lot of skill in this major. But ultimately, if you want to be effective as a communicator, you have to be sufficiently motivated to communicate well with others to make that difference happen.
Hmm. So what have you seen, just thinking more about UMD and our campus climate in the 3 years you've been here, what do you see as kind of where we're at, strengths, where we need to go?
It feels like we're still uneasy.
Yeah.
Which is hard for me to countenance in 2019, but it feels like we're uneasy. it feels like as a campus, it's a fragile campus in a lot of ways, not just about diversity and inclusion. It's just an emotionally fragile campus. It might have something to do with the budget cuts. It might have something to do with our status in higher ed. I'm not really entirely sure about that. And it also feels like we're very much connected to the community, which is great. But on the other hand, when things happen in the community, it stirs up the campus. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's one more thing. It's one more variable we can't control with inside the university that we have to pay attention to. I think for us as an institution, we need to be able to have more real conversations. And they can start to be superficial, but we need to be in the habit of having conversations. And we need to be in the habit of respectfully disagreeing. Mm-hmm. We even need to be in the habit of periodically challenging each other, because that's part of what we do in higher education. And that's not an American higher education issue. It's, you know, I've lectured and visited universities in nearly 24 countries, and most of them I've seen some variation of questioning or challenging authority. Mm-hmm. It may look a little bit different. Hierarchies may be a little bit more vertical, a little bit more horizontal, but that's part and parcel of what happens in higher education. Sometimes it feels like we're afraid to do that. And I hope we start to develop the muscle memory and the inclination to exercise that part of ourselves.
You talking about having those conversations and challenging each other, it made me think of a retirement party I was recently at, and one of the retirees' colleagues talked about how what she appreciated about this colleague was, I think the way she said it was, "You challenged me while having my back." And I wrote that down because it was just such a beautiful, we often see those as mm-hmm. as opposites. Like, I can't have your back if I'm challenging you. And that mm-hmm. that was like how to bring more of that kind of challenge forward, which mm-hmm. is like, I'm going to challenge you because mm-hmm. I care about you and I'm going to have your back.
Mm-hmm.
It just struck me as mm-hmm. something worth repeating.
It is, because I mean, we're really talking about, do we care about each other?
Yeah.
And oftentimes we invest the most in each other when we want each other to grow, or we want our relationship to grow in whatever form that relationship is, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like so many things, we grow when we exercise because we challenge our body, right? We grow intellectually because we stimulate and challenge our mind.
Mm-hmm.
We grow socially because we put ourselves in different kinds of situations with different kinds of people. And we do it best when we're supported. When we're at the gym, we have a spotter, right? When we're in school, we have a teacher or a librarian or somebody who guides us.
Mm-hmm.
And in our social life, we hopefully have friends and family members who are there lifting us and nudging us at the same time,
mm-hmm.
nudging us forward. And sometimes they nudge us forward too fast and we kind of look back and say, well, not yet. But sometimes we look back and kind of give them that silent indication of, I'm not going to move forward and I need you to nudge me now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we do that because we trust the person behind us.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wish that everybody had people like that in their lives. Clearly not everybody does.
Yeah.
But I think in the university, that's really what we're good at, right? Mm-hmm. We know how to support and challenge each other. So when I see us as a learning community, that's what we are, not doing that to each other. Sometimes I think, well, wow, we must not care about each other enough.
Right, right. And missing opportunities.
Yep. Yeah. You know, pull somebody aside and said, I know why you went there, but geez, did you really have to go there now?
Mm-hmm.
Could you have gotten to the same point in a different kind of way? You know, there's this principle of equifinality. You can get to the same point through many different routes. That route, yeah, got you there faster, but wow, look at all the scorched earth you left along the way. The other route, a little bit longer, a little bit more scenic, but everybody's happy with the journey, right?
Mm-hmm.
If we can talk to each other that way,
yeah.
I think it helps us have more of those positive interactions.
Yeah.
And growing opportunities.
Are you, if you don't mind me asking, finding the ability to have those conversations with people?
No.
Okay.
No, and I think one of the challenges here is for me, is my title, right?
Yeah.
So I'm not as aware of my title generally as everybody else is. And, you know, when you're an administrator, you always know this. But still, even after 3 years, when I walk into the room, depending on the room that I'm in, the first thing that people see is my title or my function.
Mm-hmm.
and that culturally gets in the way of things. And so, you know, those moments, particularly when I'm in the classroom, particularly with first year students who don't know who I am, I'm at my most natural, because then I can just be that guy who's the professor. And if I want to use my first name, the students are fine with that. But when I'm working, for example, with employees, almost always I have to introduce myself. So people want to know what my role is. The moment I say my role and my title, for some people, I've already put up a barrier, right? It's either an intimidating title or a title that may connote some notion of conflict. To a lot of people, it's, I need to shut down. I don't feel safe because of his title and what he could do. And there's all these things that you then can't control when that phrase, EVCA, gets tossed out there. That oftentimes gets in the way. You deal with it. I mean, I can't not be that title while I'm here at UMD in this role. If I'm going to be the role, I got to carry the title with. But I do know that it creates an unnecessary barrier for some people to interact with me in a sort of free and open way.
Yeah. And yet what I heard you describe in your classroom, I can't help but think, how possible would it be for you to create that here with your title?
We do the best that we can. So, for example, when I taught the freshmen, there's a line on my syllabus that says instructor. All it has is my name.
Yeah.
Doesn't have my degree, doesn't have anything else, right? When I pass it out, I say, if you need to, you can call me Professor Delgado Fernando's fine. That's the end of it, right? When I taught the seminar a couple of years ago, 4 weeks into the semester, one of the students got very involved in student government. One of my colleagues took the university org chart to student government to orient the young people. That young man came back into class and held up the org chart and said, is that you? And I said, uh-huh.
Shoot.
And the entire class kind of looked at him like, oh my God, the vice principal's been teaching us, right?
Welcome to Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Right. Yeah. And so we had to then joke about, let's not get caught up in the title. I'm still the same person who was teaching the last 3 weeks, two and a half weeks. Let's not worry about it. But it was clear for a number of the young students in the classroom, it was like, oh, this isn't just some random university employee who was assigned to us. This person has this other role. Mm-hmm. And I'm sad that it happened that early in the semester, but still it happened long enough into the semester that most of the students could see past the title, because they'd already had a number of experiences with me.
Yeah.
Where it was open. But unfortunately, especially when you first start, every time I walked into the room, what'd they do? They introduced me through my administrative title. So a priori, people are like, oh, we want to talk to the EVCA. First thing that happens, well, this is the Executive Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs, the number two guy on campus. Oh, and you could see eyes go down.
Yeah.
Or you could see people shut down. I think over time, people understand that you want to have a conversation with me. Have a conversation with me. You want to disagree with me? Eh, that's fine too. But I do know that there are rooms that I walk into that people just feel discomforted by the fact that I carry this title.
How about your, it's more than that. If you can think of something, this is the theme of our campaign, and just the idea that, I mean, you've already given some examples, but I think of it as if you only know one story or part of me, you don't know the whole story. So, or something that's happened, or just
sure. Yeah, there's lots of ways to answer.
What comes up for you? Yeah.
For me, it's more than that. It's more than one identity label, right?
Yeah.
So with the variety of identity labels that I choose to inhabit, or that I think are regularly projected onto me, are a number of identity labels, that have a lot of privilege associated with them. And that can be great, because with privilege, you can do cool things, right? Mm-hmm. You can do a lot of bad things too. But I think what people forget is whatever that privilege is whatever it is, and it's oftentimes contextual. At the end of the day, my identity labels that function in social relationships are complex and multiple. So I'm middle-aged, I'm straight. I'm Christian in orientation. I'm Latino. I'm first generation college student. I'm first generation American. Hmm. I'm bilingual. I'm a dad. I'm a brother. all of those things are functionally important to me. People will tend to see each other through the one or two labels that are most prevalent, most obvious to them. And we end up defining ourselves in different kinds of ways. But people define us by the relatively small number of labels that they think sort of fix us. And so it's hard for people sometimes to understand. It's been like this in every institution when I've been an administrator. But when I go home and I'm playing superheroes with my 10-year-old, it doesn't matter to her that I'm the chief academic officer at UMD. And when I'm trying to pick the best set of superheroes so that I can win our war, I'm not really thinking through in that clear-headed way that an academic officer needs to. Mm-hmm. I'm just a dad trying to have fun with his 10-year-old and trying to pick the best set of superheroes so that my team wins, right? It's just about play in that moment. Mm-hmm. And I think people end up defining themselves in complex ways, but not giving that space to the other person.
Right. Yeah.
And forgetting that they're complex in all sorts of ways.
Yeah.
You know, in a previous job, we had a big debate with a group of faculty, and another faculty member sent me a long email saying, please don't be mad at these two faculty members. They've given lots of years of service to the university. These are all the ways in which they've contributed. Don't put them on a blacklist. And I wrote back saying, A, I don't have a blacklist. B, I understood why they were angry. I still disagree, and I think that I and my team were right. But I understand why they disagree. And see, and this is most importantly, I'm now sitting at home. Whatever that was 3 hours ago at work is not here.
Yeah.
And I'm not wasting any more time worrying about how intense that conversation was.
Yeah.
It was what it needed to be in that moment. And hopefully amidst all of the talking, there was enough listening. But right now I'm helping my fourth grader with her math, and that seems like an arduous enough journey. So I'm not really worried about whether or not that person is my friend or enemy at work. That person is a colleague who needed to express themselves in a particular kind of way, and hopefully they've moved on.
Mm-hmm.
So it was telling because of how that person saw administrators. They probably saw administrators, frankly, in that way because they'd have, at least at that institution, previous histories with administrators interacting in a particular kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
But the net effect is that they felt because I occupied that same title now that I needed to be in that mold. And my reaction is I can be in that mold. I'm not saying I'm perfect, but I've got two little ones at home and they're making demands on my time. And I don't really have the bandwidth to worry about taking out a little black book, putting in a date, dear diary, Professor X did this to me. And so I'm going to hold this against them for the rest of their natural life. Exclamation point, please remember this at merit next month.
It's a lot of energy.
It's a lot of energy, right?
Yeah.
And you know, explaining fractions to a 9-year-old takes up way more energy than that. And so it took a while for that faculty to understand that I could walk in a room and say, I think we're going to argue, so we got 57 minutes. Let's go. Yeah. Let's argue. And recognize that 4 minutes past that as I'm walking to the next meeting, I have compartmentalized
it. Okay.
It's over there. It's different. We move on. But people kind of forget that.
Yeah.
And I think they forget that because, again, as we see each other, if we see ourselves three-dimensionally, we see the other two-dimensionally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you walk into a meeting at UMD and people know your role, so let's say three identities you've mentioned that are most obvious. So you're EVCAA, you're male, and you're Latino. What do you think is most salient, or does it depend on the context?
I think it depends on the context, but inside the university, I think the title.
Yeah.
Okay. I've had so many experiences in higher ed, particularly when I became an administrator, where frankly the title, it doesn't erase my gender, it actually reinforces the gender, and there's a whole critique that I think we share that we could get into. But it does tend to erase my race and my ethnicity.
Interesting.
So that even people of color, inside the institution no longer see me as a person of color. They see me as an administrator, this sort of other thing, which is kind of weird because though I carry that title in other places, so when I go to my professional organization and I still interact with faculty and graduate students there, they still see me as a PhD, as a senior scholar, as a professor, as somebody who has this administrative appointment, so has insight to provide advice, and they see me as a mentor and an ally.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the people who might occupy those very same demographic characteristics here on campus, whether they're faculty and staff, have erased all of my parallel or similar demography and have reduced me to the administrator.
Mm-hmm. And so like become, a sellout kind of way? Or?
No, not like a, no, well, maybe.
Okay.
I'd have to ask them.
Okay.
No, I think more like he can't understand or he doesn't have empathy or he's just an administrator.
Mm-hmm.
And I can be those things. I mean, goodness knows I have my blind spots. But it is interesting when I can step into a meeting on campus, whether it's here or one of my previous institutions, and it's clear people don't see me as a raced faculty member.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day be somewhere else in the country at a convention, there on a panel, because I'm one of the few full professors of my ethnicity in my field talking about that journey.
Mm-hmm.
And that dislocation sometimes is weird.
Yeah.
Because it's like, well, you know, back in Duluth, I guess I've stopped being Latino, but now I'm in Chicago at this hotel being invited to talk because I'm Latino,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
As a faculty member. Yeah. And it reconciling those two positions and how people see them is sometimes interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really struck by just in a deeper way understanding the self-fulfilling, it's not even prophecy, but the circular mess up that is.
It does get weird.
Yeah.
It does get weird. You know, I have former students now who are full professors who are now at that place where they have an opportunity to be a department head or an associate dean or even a dean.
Mm-hmm.
And though socially and culturally, racially, they've made peace with their community of origin and said, okay, now I'm a PhD, now I'm a professor. Yes, I feel more distant from my community, but I haven't lost my tie. I haven't lost my appreciation. This next step seems like the final sort of jumping the river.
Hmm.
And they grapple with it. And I have to remind them, well, what kind of leader do you want? Well, I want a leader who's caring. Great. Do you want a smart leader? Absolutely. You want a thoughtful leader who can make good decisions? Absolutely. Do you want somebody who has a good moral compass? Yes. Do you possess those? Well, yeah, I think so. Then why wouldn't you take up that call? Because if you don't take up the call, somebody who might not possess those pieces is going to take up the call.
Mm-hmm.
So don't you do yourself a disservice and don't you do your colleagues a disservice by not taking up that call. And so one of my colleagues who's, we've had this sort of mentoring relationship for 20 plus years, she now is in a position to mentor me with my scholarship, grapples with this. And I said, you know, I long ago made peace that I wasn't going to be on the research track. And that was one of the things that I had to give up.
Mm-hmm.
And part of giving that up meant a voice in the field that talked about diverse issues was going to be absented from the field. The flip side was I was in a position to make decisions about who got to go to graduate school, how they got supported, who got hired, who got promoted.
Mm-hmm.
How did we recruit, particularly faculty? And so I reframe my activism away from teaching and scholarship to using the processes and the tools available to an administrator to follow the rules, for sure, but also to play within the boundaries of the rules in those gray areas where a leader can choose to exercise judgment and decision making.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that was my job now is to create space in my field and in my institutions for more diversity in the various ways in which we define diversity. And that's how I promote my activism. You know, I think one of the things we need to think about as a learning institution is that we're always constantly learning. Sometimes when we're in our jobs, we actually atrophy because we don't learn the way we did as students, which is a lot of subjects simultaneously.
Hmm.
We end up specializing, and that tends to shrink and atrophy our vistas. Maybe predictable, but lamentable. I think the other thing that happens, particularly as a faculty member, is we're so primed to have all the answers that sometimes we worry about getting things wrong or seeming inadequate or being corrected. And goodness knows, if I'm in a communication class and a student calls me out because I got a theory that I ought to know wrong, yeah, that's embarrassing. And hopefully that's just an off day and not of something more longer term with my mental faculties. But there's a whole host of topics and conversations that I can be a party to that I can learn from every day. And I don't need to have all the answers. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes people, particularly highly educated people, don't take the opportunity to put themselves in those conversations because they may not want to seem inadequate. But the reality is all of us is inadequate at something. Mm-hmm. And sure, I'm completely inadequate at golf, so I don't play. And that's okay. I don't need to play golf, right? But at the workplace, if I'm completely inadequate in interacting with a certain important, because every segment is important, so a certain segment of our student or our staff population, that's not appropriate, mm-hmm. right? I'm supposed to be the chief academic officer for everybody. And everybody ought to feel at least minimally respected and understood and appreciated by somebody in my role. And so sometimes I make mistakes. Probably the most obvious one I can point to is I had a colleague, a direct report, sitting in front of me, and I was thinking of something else as we were talking. And so I wasn't processing everything very clearly. And so I made a comment that is a fairly standard comment that in some communities can be seen as very offensive. And then I said it, not wanting to be offensive, not even necessarily meaning it in that way, mm-hmm. but I wasn't paying attention to what I was saying or to whom I was saying it. And I looked up and I realized if there was going to be somebody on campus who was going to be offended by that comment, this is one of about 24 people on campus who would be offended. And I didn't say anything, and that person didn't say anything. And I let it lie. And then the next, about 2 weeks later, we had another meeting. And I said, before we begin, and before it gets too awkward,
yeah.
I said something the last time we met. And I didn't mean it, but I know what it means. And I know what it can mean. And I just want to say, I completely apologize. That was inappropriate for me to share. It was one of those moments where I was thinking of X, we were talking about Y. And as I responded to you, I was thinking about my emotional reaction to the previous conversation, and I blurted something out. And, you know, I hope I did not offend you, because I obviously didn't mean to offend you, but you have every right to be offended. And he looked at me and he said, well, I was thinking about it. Hmm. And I'm glad you said that. I wasn't really offended because I know who you are and where you're coming from, but I was surprised you said it.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you called it out. And I said, you know, if I ever said anything or if I ever say anything like that in that ballpark and you hear it, please let's, you know, and he said, yeah. Oh yeah, of course, no problem. And then we got on about our business, right? So here I am, I got a PhD in communication studies. I know how to model these kinds of things. I know what many of these metaphors and sayings are, these aphorisms are. And yet in a moment where I wasn't conscious about what I was saying and have playing two different conversations in my head and reacting to one emotionally when I've got this other person about a different subject in mm-hmm. front of me, I said something wildly inappropriate in my mind.
Yeah.
Other people might have said, oh, it's not that bad, whatever.
Right.
Wildly inappropriate in my own head.
Right.
And the best thing to do is not pretend it didn't happen, but just to go to the person and say, I think I really messed up and I apologize.
Mm-hmm.
And that person reacted the way most people did. Yeah, it wasn't that big a deal, but I thank you for apologizing, right? Because it gives him that space, in this case, to feel that much more comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And he, in turn, compassionately said, okay, you're off the hook. I absolve you of that sin because I understand that you're genuine about your apology. Let's move on. Let's learn to interact in better ways. Fair enough.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes admitting that weakness sometimes in higher ed is difficult for us.
Yeah.
It may be difficult for us as faculty members. Oftentimes it's difficult for us to be administrators. But if we can model and acknowledge those gaps and those deficits,
mm-hmm.
it sends a powerful message, I think, to people, particularly to students.
Yeah, I agree.
And I think sometimes we don't avail ourselves of those moments mm-hmm. in very authentic ways.
Well, which is really a disservice to students, I think.
It is.
Because that's, I mean, learning involves not, you don't know how to do it right the first time or you wouldn't need to learn it, right?
Right.
So there's some error involved. And if we don't afford that to each other, I agree.
Yep.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So I do provide a little gratitude from my farm.
Oh, this was the egg reference.
This was the egg reference.
Oh,
yes.
Nice.
So you can.
Are they colored?
No, they're.
Oh, why? No, I mean, like, you know, sometimes you get the brown and
right,
the orange, right?
Right. Yeah. Yes. No, it is. It's because they're Icelandic. I did not know this, that the color of the egg is dependent upon the breed of the chicken.
Oh.
So,
I also did not know that.
Yeah. So these are Icelandic chickens, and all of their eggs look the same, and they're that color. It's kind of a creamy white, I think.
Nice.
Not the bleached white, but
well,
yeah.
I will use this to make a Spanish dish.
And they have very yellow yolks.
Yolks?
Yellow, very, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
That'd be a good color.
It'll be a great color.
Thank you.
All right. Take a picture of the dish.
I will.
Okay. All right. And then there's this really great outro music.
Ooh.
That'll happen, and we're done. You can listen to more episodes of UMD's It's More Than That podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. Visit d.umn.edu/campusclimate to find additional information on our episodes and more about what the University of Minnesota Duluth is doing to build a better, more welcoming campus community for all. And you can sign our pledge and work with us on your own personal journey.